joining us for another 60 on 60 all-time Angels list with Halo Life. I'm your host, BJ Martin of Halo Life. I'm joined once again by Stu Matthews of AngelsNation.com. Thank you for joining us. We've been counting down the 60 greatest Angels of all time based on this somewhat controversial formula that that Halo Life has created. I began working on this last year. Takes into account Fangraphs, Baseball Reference War, awards voting, all-star appearances, postseason appearances, some other factors. And we created a rating for all the players as they played in an Angels uniform. Did not take into account any of our personal bias and love or hatred toward a player. And it does not reflect any of the work that they did outside of their Angels playing day. So it's players only during their time with the Angels. We've already gone through the 46 through 60, and that list included Don Aussie, Bartolo Colon, Garrett Richards, Kendrys Morales, Benji Molina, Rick Reichert, George Brunette, Brian Harvey, Clyde Wright, Don Baylor, Orlando Cabrera, Jeff Zahn, Mike Napoli, Fred Lynn, and David Eckstein. And today we're going to count down, and we're going to start our countdown, resume it, I should say, at 45. And that 45th player on the all-time Angels 60 on their 60th anniversary would be a man born as Charles Theodore Davis, but all of us would call him Chili. Chili Davis, the designated hitter, came to the team after spending seven seasons in San Francisco with the Giants, joined the Angels as a major free agent signing in December of 1987. Stu Matthews, what do you remember about Chili Davis?
I remember him coming to, like you do. I was a fan during the time when he came. And of course with the Giants, he was a star. I mean, it was a big free agent signing. It was significant, good player, good signing for the Angels. And with him, he ended up playing two stints with the Angels. And on his first stint, he showed production immediately. It wasn't one of the Angels free agent signings that just tanked. Chili Davis was worth the money they paid him on the first stint, and actually for his entire career as an Angel. Raw athlete, tried to play outfield, raw athlete, tons of power, and really a reliable bat, and a good guy, just a good guy. Of course, born in Kingston, Jamaica, and he's a godfather to Devon White's daughter, which is interesting, because for the time there, the Angels had Devon White and Chili. They had two Jamaican-born players on the team at the same time, which is interesting. But he was a star, and he produced for the Angels, you know. Hit 27 homers in 1993, you know. You can't argue with that.
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting time for the Angels. A lot of the players, some of them we've already named on this list, that kind of came in the early 80s. There were a lot of veterans, you know, the Reggie Jacksons were being brought in, the Fred Lynns, the Don Baylors that had come and gone, you know, and it seemed like there was a lot of money invested by Gene Autry and the front office in the early part of the decade. And what it was funny going back and researching his signing, it was a 1 year, $810,000 deal. And that was a big deal at the time for a free agent. And it ended a drought of major free agent signings. The last major free agent signing the Angels had prior to that, according to what I was reading at the time, I think it was a Sporting News article, was Frank Licordi in 1983. That was how long they'd gone. It was almost, it was 4 years. You know, you think about how upset us as fans get by, like, you know, Perry Manasian only getting, you know, guys on 1 year deals. The Angels weren't even doing that, you know, for a 4 year period. And they transitioned. And as you said, the guys that come, they kind of went with the farm players. They brought up Pettis, Schofield, Devon White, as you mentioned, Mark McLemore was coming up. and Jack Howell had kind of resumed, taken over at third base. And you saw kind of this change. And so, yeah, Chile was a big part of that. He throwing him in that order with guys like Wally Joyner and Johnny Ray really gave a middle of the order presence. And of course he played 7 years in the National League. So he was a left fielder, right fielder. I think he played some center field there. So when he came to the Angels, I think he played left field the first part of his career there. I think he probably had Brian Downey and some other guys DH, beginning the DH at that time. And then they re-signed him. He played four more years on that first time with the Angels. And he kind of converted himself. He kind of became a DH during that time. And the interesting thing you said, I thought was interesting, Stu, was he had two stints. So he left in 91 and he left to the right time, the right team, because he ended up going to the Minnesota Twins and he won a World Series that first year away from the Angels. So then he got that out of his system. He was able to come back. Unfortunately, didn't bring that World Series winning back, but he was, I think even the second time when he came back, he was even more productive in a lot of ways as a full-time designated hitter. You know, I was looking at 19, he came back, he hit 27 home runs and a career best 112 RBIs that first season back. And then he made the All-Star team that year, 94. And then 95, he had a career high 318. And at the end of his career with the Angels, 279 average, 156 home runs, 618 RBIs. It's a real impressive career for a switch hitting designated hitter in Chili Davis.
And it's strange, you know, because in high school, he played at Dorsey High School in downtown Los Angeles. He was 10 years old when he came over from Jamaica and didn't know a thing about baseball, didn't know who Babe Ruth was or anything like that. He was 10 years old and he got into the LA school system. Dorsey High is in downtown LA and there's not a lot of, you know, he actually said that baseball saved him perhaps from he was a rebellious kid, he said, and that perhaps he would have ended up getting into a gang or getting into drugs. Baseball saved him from that. And of course, in high school, he was such a raw athlete and so powerful. He was playing catcher in high school. He was a catcher and a first baseman at Dorsey High School. And, you know, then ends up as an outfielder in the major leagues, ends up as a switch hitter. You know, only batted from the right side, even when he got into pro ball. So here's a guy who really, baseball turned him into what he was. There's still some shots of him playing cricket, you know, like stories you hear of Chili Davis growing up in Jamaica, playing cricket as a little boy. And he still plays that a little bit now and then when he goes back out, you know, to the islands in the Caribbean, plays cricket from time to time. And he's trying to improve baseball in retirement. He's trying to improve baseball in Jamaica. I think it's a wonderful thing that these, you know, retired players do, is to you know, help produce, to develop players over there, change them from cricket players into baseball players, get the fields improve the coaching and all that. Because you see players come out of Curaçao right now, Andrelton Simmons and Xander Bogaerts, and you can start naming them, you know, Jonathan Scope are coming from an island country called Curaçao, but there's not been that many Jamaicans, you know, and a lot of talent there. You look at Usain Bolt, you know, what if he would have played baseball? So that's what you're looking at.
Yeah. And he's had a good career recently as a hitting coach. He was, I think, Joe Maddon's hitting coach at the Cubs just a few years ago. So he's still in the game. He's still making an impact. And after that last stint with the Angels, I think he went to the Yankees during their pennant run, had some time with those clubs with Jeter and O'Neill and sorts. So, great ball player, 45th on our list.
I was just going to hit you with some trivia.
You got trivia on Chili Davis?
You ready for some trivia?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Just okay. He's seventh all time in Major League history for home runs by a switch hitter. That's a lot. Seventh is pretty good. All time homers by a switch hitter. I'm just going to see if you can just pin a number on how many times Chili Davis hit a home run from both sides of the plate in the same game. It's a wow. It's actually, yeah, just take a stab, throw a dart.
I'm guessing he probably hit about 300 to 350 in his, maybe 300 in his career. So I would guess maybe he had five games where he did that.
Actually, 11.
11 so games. 11. That's impressive. Wow.
But from each side. And then right, and he got into switch hitting in the instructional league with the Giants organization. He was a right-handed hitter only, and he just said to his coaches, you know, look, man, I'm having trouble hitting the slider. When a right-handed pitcher throws me a slider, man, I'm, you know, and they said, hey, why not try that from the left side? And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he hit a lot of bombs from both sides. He was, you know, he was played most of his games against right-handed pitching. You know, as a major leaguer.
Yeah, so he batted from the left side, and he was pretty equal the challenge both sides of the plate, from what I remember. And yeah, as a fan, I always loved seeing him. I hated seeing him go. Both times he left the team, because I mean he was just someone you could count on in the middle of that order. And I think that, like I said, that second stint, I think he was a more well-rounded hitter. He really came into his own as his career progressed. He became a better hitter, I think, with age, honed his craft. You hate to see him go when he did.
He got traded as well to the Royals, I believe it was, for a man that a lot of younger listeners to your podcast would definitely know.
Mark Gubin, the voice, one of the voices of the Angels, right?
Yeah, Gooby was what came to the Angels' way in a trade for Chili Davis. So, neat guy, great personality. You know, I don't know why he's rated so low on this list, but, you know, I imagine you're going to tell everybody at the end.
Yeah, 45 is not low. I mean, I think it's pretty good rating. He's 45 on this list, but yeah. Yeah, I think what hurt him probably with the formula was not being on the Angels during a playoff period. It was a playoff drought, so he didn't get those postseason credits that a lot of these players on this list are getting, and that would be I'm sure one of the reasons he's probably higher on this list than he should be. So, so anyway, number 45. I think this is somebody, Stu, that you've actually reached out and spoke to recently. So I'm excited to go to number 44 on the list. He's one of the original 1961 Angels, the expansion team. It's a 5'5" outfielder by the name of Albie Pearson. And this is before me and Stu were ever watching baseball games for the Angels. As far as I know, Stu, you might surprise me on here on this one. I don't remember seeing Albie Pearson live, but what can you recall about Albie Pearson?
I have spoken to him recently, and also like right during the 2002 season. And I can just say, what a nice man. But I have to correct you that he's not 5'5", and quite often he'll remind people that he's 5'5" and 5'8". And he used to remind people, don't forget that 5'8". But he is one of the smallest full-time players, impact players. 5'5" is not small. So he was a leadoff man as well. And what a wonderful, nice guy. But the thing is, he was a spark plug, leadoff man from the left side, being 5'5". A guy like that comes up, and the pitchers have got to really concentrate on command and location just to throw strikes to him. And so when they threw strikes to him, he had a little bit of pop in his bat and great base runner. And so, you know, he was an instrumental guy on those early Angels teams, 1961. I believe he played until 66, wasn't it, with the Angels?
66 was his last career with the Angels. Yeah. So the first five seasons with the club. And again, he was their fourth selection. He played with Washington Baltimore for a few years before, and he was the fourth selection by the Angels in the expansion draft before the 61 season. And he'd have a great rookie season. He'd hit .288 for the team. And in their first game, you said he's a leadoff hitter, and I believe he did lead off a lot. But actually, the first game in Angels history, which took place at Baltimore's Memorial Stadium on April 11th of 1961, he was batting third in the batting order. But an interesting fact, the first two guys in that order were recorded as outs. He came up with two outs and was walked. So Albie Pearson was the first Angel to ever reach base in the regular season. And then the next batter, Kluszewski, would home run. So technically he went in first, so he became within a few minutes the first Angel to score a run as well. So obviously a historical member of the team. He scored 115 runs the next, his second season in 62. And in 63, he had probably his best season, where he hit 304, had a 402 on base, stole 17 bases. He'd also make his lone all-star appearance for the team in 1964 and actually finished 14th in AL MVP voting that year. So, just one of those guys, I think, that was, we talked about Eckstein on the last podcast, 60 on 60. And I think Pearson, again, was just so beloved by fans. A lot of it probably had to do with his diminutive stature, the 5'5" and 5'8". People just love rooting for a guy like that. You know, when you look at him and you walk by on the street, you'd probably think he's a shoe salesman, you know, and yet, you know, this guy goes out on the field every day and just like makes it happen. So just, you'd love to see guys like that. I wish I was just a few years older doing and had the opportunity to see him live.
He's such a nice man too. He's not around. He lives out in the desert now. I believe they live out in Coachella Valley. Him and his wife, Helen have been married for years upon years. Wonderful, wonderful man. Always a great smile. Wonderful smile. And he has some great stories of those early Angels. And I was talking about spring trainings in Palm Springs. And he told me a great story about how happy he was to have, you know, Gene Autry, you know, brought a lot of stars there. And Albie Pearson was telling me about how President Dwight D. Eisenhower was a big Angels fan when the club was just formed. Now you're talking Eisenhower. This is Ike. This is who was the general who led the D-Day invasion in World War II.
And this would have been, 2 years removed from his presidency, probably, you know, 61, right? He just right out of office.
And so Albie Pearson said, you know, Uncle Gene said, you know, let's give a present to the president, Dwight D. Eisenhower. And so the whole team signed a bat, and Albie Pearson was sent over to go meet Eisenhower at his golf club, at the country club, handed it to him on his putting green. And Ike was just like so thrilled to receive a bat signed by those young kids, the baseball team that Ike rooted for out in Rancho Mirage or somewhere, you know. And it was just a bat signed by young kids, but Ike loved it. So, I mean, this is wonderful how Albie Pearson connects us through the generations of, we talk about the greatest generation of World War II and the very first Angels teams. And he's got stories like that. You know, Albie Pearson, the way he got it drafted by the Angels was he actually wrote a letter, you know, hand typed a letter and sent it to the general manager, Fred Haney. Haney was the very first Angels general manager, and he sent a letter that was convincing enough to Fred Haney to say, hey, would you please draft me? And boy, he was really good. And of course now, you know, he's still alive, and he was rookie of the year 1 year, 1958, for the Washington Senators. He's got 5 daughters, 17 grandkids, and I think it was something like 16 great-grandchildren. And of course he runs ministry. He's him and his wife, he's a deeply religious man. He tells me stories about how he met Marilyn Monroe one time and wanted to try to bring the Lord to her, you know, but he didn't want to come off as seeing weird, you know. He didn't want to be seen as a religious nut. So he never said anything to Marilyn Monroe, but he felt bad about the fact that he didn't, because she died in 1963, you know, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. He really wanted to, he prayed for her, said. He prayed for her. And, you know, he set up, missionaries to Spain, Italy, Russia, Mexico, Ecuador, all over the world, Guatemala. You know, he didn't make that much in his career. I think his maximum salary he ever got was you know, $33,000. But what a fan, he gives most of it away. And what a fantastic man. I just don't think you're going to find too many nicer guys that you'll ever meet who wasn't an Angel. And it's considered an Angel's great. And I think statistically, by your measure, you know, he belongs right there, number 44 or, you know, on your list, center fielder. And he was the Angels' first leadoff man.
He was, and he wasn't there during a playoff. They didn't make a playoff series during his stint, so he didn't get any bonus points for that. His rookie of the year came before the Angels. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, he was a rookie of the year with the Senators. But yeah, I mean, what you just described. I mean, like whatever greatness he had on the field, he was even sound like had a greater, more successful life off the field. And yeah, I just love to see somebody like that being recognized here, 44 on this list. So
I agree. Unfortunately, he had to have his career cut short because even though he was small and wasn't a massive man, he suffered his entire career with back problems. He had a problem that came back, recurring problem, just bad discs, herniated discs, and those sorts of things would put him on the shelf for a little while. And at age 31, you know, that's the way they played back then. He ruptured two discs in his back, making a hard slide to try to break up a double play. And, you know, a hard-nosed ball player, but absolutely wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man. I can't say enough about him.
And yeah.
I just can't.
Thank you for sharing, Steve. I mean, that was a great testimony for him. And you're right. I mean, 31 years old is when his career ended. He had 831 total hits with his career, 618 of those coming as the majority of his career was spent with the Angels. But yeah, only 9-year career. I mean, so, you know, you think about like a ruptured disc in his back today, you'd imagine a player would have surgery on that, would come back and probably play another 6 or 7 seasons of someone like Pearson's stature. But like, you know what, God had another plan for him. And obviously he's made the best of it off the field and how he served and done great things for the community. So that's Albie Pearson, number 44, number 43, this pitcher, it's a pitcher, probably one of the most durable pitchers that I can ever remember seeing, either starter or reliever. This guy had a rubber arm. I think I probably just gave it away when I said rubber arm. Scott Shields, the right-handed, lanky right-handed reliever that came up with the Angels in the early 2000s and would just be a bulldog and would get out there on the mound. And he'd give you, if you needed one or two outs, he'd get those to you. If you needed them to go 2 or 3 innings, he'd do that for you as well. Stu, you were working in the Angels front office at the time that Scott Shields came up. What do you recall about Scott Shields and his tenure with the Angels?
Reliable, you know, holds, giving the ball in the 7th or the 8th, and Mike Sosa never hesitated to use him that way. Now, when you look at his career stats, they're not going to blow you away, but I don't think that you could find a guy who's, you know, just instrumental in the role that he played as a setup man. Do you know how many holds he had that the stat called holds? There was a ton of them.
I looked that up. He had during his Angel tenure and his whole career was with the Angels. He had 155 holds in 491 total games.
Yeah. And he was setting up for two guys who were elite closers. You know, he began setting up for Troy Percival, who's as good as it gets in Angels history. And then he also played on a lot of very, very good Angels teams that won a lot of games, never really quite got all the way there, setting up for Francisco Rodriguez. And I guarantee you, if you asked Troy Percival today what he liked most about Shields was that it was rare that he was ever going to warm up and have to come into a game and try to save the game, inheriting some kind of mess that Scott Shields created. You know, it was like Scott Shields did not have those games where he was just off and Troy Percival had to, you know, clean it up with runners on base and, you know, one out. He was just reliable, effective, 700 innings in his Angels career. And I was talking to Bill Stoneman recently, the former Angel GM, of course, who won it all. You know, Stoneman won it all, and he knows, he talks a lot about a lot of people. Stoneman told me it wasn't about the quality of the innings that Scott Shields were going to give you, but it was when he could do it, because he could do it at any time. He'd come out of the pen in the sixth and, you know, shut him down. He made a few starts, you know, 13 spot starts. And, you know, I think if you look at his entire career, and I love these guys who played their whole career with the Angels, you know, he made good money in the final years of his career. He was on, you know, $5 million a year contracts as a setup man. And that's rare today to get $5 million a year as a setup guy. And he made, you know, something more than $20 million in his entire career. And he said, well, my baseball career set my daughters up for life. You know, I was never an all-star. He never received one major award. His postseason ERA was 3.20. You know, he was a key guy on the team that on very good teams. And, you know, he had stuff. He could throw you a hard sinker and a wicked curveball. And just, wow, number 62. Who would think that a setup guy would be on your list? But he was, he would come into situations in Angel Stadium when it was really loud and there was some trouble on the base pass, and really put out the fire before any more damage happened, or he would just hold the game for the team to rally with the thunder sticks and everything and make the stadium really loud. He never got the glory, but without him, you know, what would those teams have been?
That's right. And this is an interesting segment that we're counting on here. We're going to get to another player who's very interesting, like Shields, because he didn't get a lot of fanfare. You're right. I mean, he just went out there and got the job done. As an Angel fan who's always followed the farm system, I remember Scott Shields as a single A player coming up and seeing, and one thing I noticed right away, he spent a few years at the bullpen, but he had a really good strikeout to innings pitch ratio and kept the ERA down at the low levels. And then he started starting games when he got up to high A and double A. The one thing I noticed was, you know, in 99, he struck out 194 batters in 182 innings, 34, he made 19 starts. And when you're back then, you know, you'd either listen to the game streamed on a local radio, streaming was just coming out in around 2000 on the radio or internet. And you'd listen to a broadcast. I think he was at Erie. It might've been the team he was with. I can't recall for certain, but it seemed like every time he started a game, he would start getting into trouble like around the fifth inning, sixth inning. And you saw this trend happening in the minors at double A and triple A. And like, it just seemed like he was cut out to be in the bull, to be a reliever, you know. It worked out for him. And he had a great career, as you mentioned. He made 13 starts in 2003. And even though he played behind, as you mentioned, Percival and K-Rod, and I think his final season was the after K-Rod, we had Fuentes, and Angels had Fuentes and Fernando Rodney saving games. He was still there setting up games, but he did save 21 games even in his career. And just an extraordinary reliever. I mean, I think he wasn't built to be a closer because he was built to pitch two or three innings. But I would go out and say, as an Angel fan, we haven't had a guy in the bullpen that was as good as Scott Shields the past decade. I think if he played the last decade with the Angels, you'd say far and away this guy was the best closer of his era. I think he was overshadowed playing with Percival and K-Rod, but his reputation with the rubber arm was like legendary. I remember the national broadcast, everyone would point out the fact when this guy was in high school, he pitched a doubleheader and pitched 300, you know, through 300 pitches. It was like he had this like legendary status of being able to recover from pitching, and you know, you look at 2003, he made 13 starts, but in 44 games, he pitched 148 innings. The next season, all out of the bullpen, in 60 games, he pitched 105 innings. So you can do the math and you can figure, you know, he's going one and a third to one and two thirds every, on average, every game he's out there. He's not going out for three outs. He's going out for close to two innings every one of those appearances. And yeah, just a great player. And he finished his career a 3.18 ERA. I know some people don't like look at the ERA stat, but I think that's still a good indicator of just, you know, how this guy was able to keep runs off the board. And, you know, struck out 8 batters per 9, walked 3.6, you know, kept the ball in the ballpark, 0.7 home runs per nine. And not many players on this list can say they played their beginning of their career from single A to the end of their career with the Angels. There may be one other player on this list that did that. And, but he spent his entire professional career with the Los Angeles Anaheim Angels. So number 42 on our list, this is the one that's kind of controversial. We said this is an unbiased list. I put a formula together. This is the one that probably raised the most eyebrows on this list because it did shock me. I think Stu would probably agree because you don't think of this guy necessarily as a starter at any point, really, when you're going into a season. But the guy was there for 9 years. He provided steady play every year. And over those 9 seasons, he got a number 42 ranking on the list. And that is Mighty Meiser Asteris. I know.
Yeah. Okay. I'm really hoping that you reveal the secret to your formula at the end of the whole thing, because I can't figure it out. And I'm wondering how he ends up on there. But yet he's a guy who I think of as, well, he wasn't a spare part. He was too influential. He was too important to the Angels teams that he played for. He wasn't a spare part. But he could start second, shortstop, third, little Mighty Meiser Asteris. You know, he came up as a shortstop with the Expos and the Venezuelan shortstop with, you know, just unbelievable amounts of talent. Now, you know, he's not close to the Angels Hall of Fame or my own personal on angelsnation.com Hall of Fame, but he's a good guy and really reliable. And I really, really always liked
him. Yeah. Like you said, he played 1 year with Montreal, and this is a great trade. This is one of the better trades. I think was 2005. Was Stoneman still there? I think Stoneman might've pulled this one off. But it was the Expos had just officially become the Washington Nationals that offseason. And the Angels dealt Jose Guillen, who had become a kind of a problem, if you will, in the clubhouse. And they traded him to the Nationals, and they received Juan Rivera along with Meiser Asteris. Both those guys just made such an impact for the Angels during the next like 6 to 7 years. But Asteris played 8 years with the Angels between 2005 and 2012, and the guy played pretty much equal, like almost like between short, second, and third, you know, pretty much equally, at a time when the Angels went from Adam Kennedy to Howie Kendrick at second. They transitioned from Eckstein to Cabrera to Ibar during his tenure at short, and they went from Troy Gloss to McPherson to Figgins and down the list at third base. So, I mean, he never had an opening to start. I mean, there were always guys starting those three positions, but if there was ever a guy who had a hangnail, if there was ever a guy who was a little limp on the day, you could plug Asteris in there and you could count on him doing the job. I mean, I'm going to go back to some stats here, Stu. I mean, just for his line, for his career, he had a .276 batting average, a .339 on base percentage, and a .380/.384 slugging, .723 OPS. So he also, although he played 759 games for the Angels, he went to the plate almost 3,000 times. He had 141 doubles, and he had 87 stolen bases. The guy was a threat on the base pass. He scored 360 runs during his time with the club as well. So, I mean, although the guy never like had a 500 at bat season, his most at bats was 449. He was, you could put film in for between 300 and 450, you know, at bats a year. And that's amazing for a guy who always had somebody kind of in front of him as a starter during that tenure. But another thing, Stu, before I give it to you, back to you, is he's one of the players as an Angel fan the last decade. I'm going back to the last decade again, that I really feel the Angels club is missed. We haven't had that dynamic role player until like recently. And that was David Fletcher. Now David Fletcher's kind of graduated into Sean Figgins territory, where he's not a utility player. You're going to find a spot for him and put him in there. But the Angels have missed this kind of a player. You know, honestly, we get excited when we see a Luis Ranjifo come up. Guy plays second. He's the closest thing we have to this, but he's not Meister Asturias. And this guy was a valuable, man. There's a lot. He was a valuable part of the early 2000s teams that were in the playoffs throughout Asturias' tenure.
Yeah, I just looked up his stats. I'm not much of a stat guy. I'm more of a story guy, as you know. You know, I'm more of a feeling guy. I think of these guys with stories rather than stats. But I was looking at his career figures. He played 326 games at third base, 315 games at second, and he came up as a shortstop. Only 222 games at short. And most of his career, I was living in England watching him on TV. And when he come up to bat, it wasn't like I would get excited. Let's put it that way. But, what a wonderful – another great guy. He would play anywhere, anytime. Like you said, when somebody had a hangnail. I was talking to Buck Rogers, you know, former Angels manager and former Angels catcher on the inaugural team. And, you know, in those days, in the 60s, guys didn't – play a game, or guys would come out of the game, you know, they shouldn't have come out of a game if they had a hangover. You know, if they drank too much, they still, you know, and had a hangover, they still played. But you're talking about, yeah, nowadays a player's not going to come out of the lineup for a hangnail, but you know what I mean. It's a similar lame excuse, and it's a wonderful guy to have on your team. I like the fact, I mean, if it's a 60-man team and consider it a 60-man roster, all these guys are useful. All of them. Meister Asturias, well, heck, you know, I think he belongs. I got a little trivia theory for you as well, so let me know when you want to put your thinking cap on.
Shoot it at me.
You ready? I don't like to put you on the spot, but I hope you enjoy these.
Okay, I'm up for some trivia. I'm bound to fail you half the time, but shoot it. Shoot at me. What is it?
Fine, but if you threw them at me, I probably couldn't get any of them, because if you're talking about numbers, I'm not going to know. But I noticed that he was going through his entire career, and of course he started in Montreal, and here's a Venezuelan shortstop who speaks Spanish, who's playing an American game in Canada, and of course he also played. I believe he finish up his career with Toronto.
He did, yeah. He either played his whole entire career with the Angel in Anaheim or in Canada.
Okay, well, there's some other guys, and I think I have the number right. I think there were five guys who played for the Angels and also played for the Jays and the Expos. So Angels, Jays, Expos, see if you can think of any of the other ones. I believe there were five.
God, man, that's tough, Stu.
I know.
I'm trying to think of one. Did Juan Rivera, I mean, besides Asturias, did he play with the Jays too?
So congratulations. That's a pat on the back right there. And I don't know if you ever drink beer, but I'm happy to buy you a beer for knowing at least one of them. Because obviously I had to look this up on the Bible of baseball stats, Baseball Reference, where they have the tool where you can, you know, find players who played for and select these three different organizations.
Yeah, because the Angels traded, so they got Rivera. So Rivera came with Asturias, and then I know the Angels traded him to the Jays. So that one I've got. But the rest of that list was Tim Foley one.
No.
No, I guess he didn't play with the Jays.
Is one Brad Fulmer? I'll run these down quick so it doesn't get too long. But there's not that many. Brad Fulmer played on all three teams. As you mentioned, Juan Rivera, John Candelaria, who was influential for a couple of years coming out of the Angels. He did. Scott Downs did. Rene Gonzalez, utility infielder for a lot of teams, and you know, wore number 88 for some reason. Rene Gonzalez was number 88. I remember that.
He was a starting third baseman for the Angels for a little while.
And Willie Frazier. So there you go. Willie Frazier was a starter.
Willie Frazier was part of the ill-fated Devon White trade to Toronto. So yeah, that good old Willie Frazier got some time in there with them. So appreciate the tribute, Stu. I'm proud I was able to get one of those guys out of that list. So that does 42. And number 41, the last on our list today, is the son of a major league player. He was junior, and he was probably one of the, I'd say, top five prospects that I think the Angels have maybe ever had come up, highly touted. And that would be Dick Schofield, the shortstop, who was groomed to be the heir apparent to Rick Burleson at the shortstop position, came up at a very young age in the early 80s for the Angels, and was ready, no doubt, defensively. But this is, as an Angel fan, before I give it to you, Stu, this is what I remember. Again, always looking down the minors. I remember looking at the media guides and seeing this 19-year-old kid that hit .330, 28 doubles and 14 home runs and 23 stolen bases at single A and triple A in 1982. I mean, and then the guy was hitting .283 his first full year at triple A. And you're thinking, man, this guy, if he can keep that at the big league level, we've got like this, we got something similar to this Ripken kid over in Baltimore. And, while his defense was right there with Cal Ripken, if not better, at the shortstop position, it's just offense never quite made it. But he's definitely on this list, I would say, because of his tenure and his defensive performance. What do you recall when we talk about Dick Schofield?
Oh, man, a lot of memories, because he was there every day playing shortstop. Career stats, he played – in his entire career, he played four games as a second baseman, two games as a third baseman, made two starts as a designated hitter, which is weird. Why would you ever have him in this DH? And 1,348 games at shortstop. This guy made career something like 3,847.43 assists. That's a lot of 6-3s in the scorebook. He wasn't a vacuum cleaner. He was so smooth, so steady. Only made 146 errors. So you're talking close to 4,000 assists and 146 errors. And I was a young baseball player playing high school ball and getting ready to play JC ball and semi-pro ball. And I kind of modeled my fielding skills and his drills. Dick Schofield just got down. I mean, his mechanics as a fielder were perfect. And that's from having a father who played in Major League Baseball, Dick Schofield Sr., Pirates, and the other teams that he played for. Just, you know, nobody was forced to play baseball in that family. But it was just like the way he got down on the ball, set to throw, threw. It was a classic shortstop. And when I was playing shortstop, I remember me and a buddy went to a game in Angels Stadium. That is when the Angels dugout was over on first base side. And of course, shortstop was on the other side. So shortstop would go across, come off the field, go across back into the dugout. I remember one inning where, I wish I could demonstrate it, but it was a third out of an inning, and Schofield just went down on it. It was a ground ball. It wasn't an easy play, but he kind of came in for it, went down on it, fired it to first base, and just kind of kept running because he knew the throw was on target. You know what I mean? He had thrown it on target, and he just kind of kept running all the way into the dugout. Maybe he had to go to the bathroom or something. I don't know. You know, maybe it was a reason he wanted to get in the dugout really fast, but it was like he went down on it through and just kept running right into the dugout. And my friend said, oh, that's wow, that was really neat the way he did it. And then I believe it was in semi-pro ball, playing shortstop, and our dugout was in the same spot. And I did the same thing and just threw it and just kind of jogged in the dugout. And it looked, you know, it might have looked really, really smooth. And my buddy said, oh, you just did a Schofield. But it's the same thing that he always did. It was the same thing his father did. His father was a steady player. Dick Schofield, the Angel, hit .320 as a batter. His dad was a career .227 hitter. They were almost exactly the same player. You know, Schofield played in the 50s.
Yeah, I think you said .320. He was a .230 hitter, yeah. Right?
And yeah, that's what I said. I almost blew it there. He was a .230 career hitter, and his dad was a .227 career hitter, and also a glove first, a smooth shortstop for the Pirates. It took over for Alvin Dark at shortstop for the Pirates. And those guys were, between them, they played 2,000 games major league in, as a shortstop between dad and son. So that's some pretty neat things for the, I mean, I think of them, and I may be wrong, as almost carbon copy players, you know, carbon copy.
For a father-son duo, yeah, absolutely. And I remember, you know, they had a few father sons. I mean, he was teammates with Bob Boone, whose dad was Ray Boone, of course. And so they had a few kids. And it's interesting when you look at doing this list, how many folks I've seen so far in compiling this and looking at each player's careers had their career year in like a playoff year for the team. And for Schofield, I think that was 1986. It was only his third full season. But as far as an all-around player with offensive ability, it was the only year he hit double digits in homers. He hit 13 home runs and 57 RBIs. Those were both career highs for him. His 23 steals that year were also a career high. And, he batted .249. Yeah. We mentioned he's a .230 lifetime hitter. And he actually received some MVP votes that year. He finished 22nd in the most valuable player voting that year. So a great career for him. But it also spanned from 83 to 1992 when he was dealt to the Mets really early in the year. But then he came back and spent a couple years in the minors and then came up a little bit for the Angels in 95 and 96. So when you look at the span of his career from 83 to 96, and Angels, he came up and he was playing shortstop with Bobby Gritch. And then by the end of his career, he was playing shortstop and the second baseman was either Randy Velarde or Damon Easley. So, I mean, this guy, his career spanned right from this old era of Angels baseball to an era when he was teammates with, I mean, he was teammates on the early side with the Senseis and Jackson and Lynn and Baylor. And the end of his career, he was teammates with Tim Salmon and Jim Edmonds and Garrett Anderson on the same field as him. So it was, he's probably one of the only player that's like bridged that gap. Yeah. Bridged that gap from the 80s team to the World Series team with his playing career. If you're going to do like the 6 degrees of Angels history. Yeah. Dick Schofield did that. He connected the dots between early success and the more recent success.
Well, he was so smooth as well as a shortstop, I suppose. I mean, he was mechanically as good as it gets. And I suppose when you say he could have played, a second baseman could have been Bobby Knopp or anybody. Dick Schofield, you know, would be ground ball in the hole, started, and he was going to throw the ball to whoever it was over there. I mean, that's how smooth he was defensively And who did you say his first Rich? So he went from Rich as a double play partner to, you know, the other guys. I think you want to talk about, I have a trivia question for you on him. And I think you want to talk about a certain home run of one of the homers that he hit.
Yeah, should be the trivia question before we close out with that moment.
Sure. Well, Dick Schofield, the one who played all his years with the Angels, has two sons. And, of course, like just like his own father did, he didn't force them to play baseball. But Dick himself is very – still around once in a while, but he's very proud of one of his sons, who is a Navy SEAL. So, I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? I think that's an interesting tidbit that one of Dick Schofield's sons became a Navy SEAL. But baseball does run in the family. He does have a family member who is a very good Major League Baseball player. And this is a trivia question. Who is it? Who is Dick Schofield's nephew?
I know this one. And I was going to interject if I thought you were going to end with just the Navy SEAL story. So I was going to actually mention this. It was Jason Wirth was his nephew, his sister's son.
Yeah. So sorry, I stole your tidbit, but we're both doing our preparation or research, or we both have some of the same memories.
No, I didn't have that in my homework, Stu. I actually
remember the home run that you want to talk about.
That is actually stored in the gray matter that is inside the skull. I didn't have that in my notes, but I just knew that as all the useless information that's in my brain. That was part of it coming out. So, but there's one moment, even though we didn't know each other back then, I was just in, you know, middle school, early first years of high school. I think you were out of high school this 1986 season, but we were both at a game together, at least for the first part of it. That was August 29th, 1986. The Angels were on a run. They were headed to the postseason, and they had many memorable moments that happened. But there's one game that I think most people that were Angel fans at the time probably will still recall this as one of the greatest moments in franchise regular season history, for sure. And that was this game against Detroit Tigers on October 29th, when the Angels were trailing by 7 runs going into the ninth inning. And they would score. Yeah. They'd get on base and score. The Detroit was started the inning with a 7-point lead with, I think, some other Ariel Lopez or some other star. They brought in the former Cy Young winner, Willie Hernandez, to try to close this thing out. And Schofield came up with the bases loaded, trailing by, I think, 3 runs at the time, and hit a walk-off home run. They scored 8 runs in the ninth inning and came back and win it. But here's the story, guys, full disclosure. Everyone likes to say, I was there that night. I was there for this. And me and Stu talked about this moment before that call.
I was too.
I was there. I was there too. And I had a couple annoying Detroit Tigers fans sitting behind my back, just like razzing me the whole time that every time that Detroit would score that game. Me, my dad, and my brother were all sitting there. So we got up. I can't remember if it was a weeknight. It might have been a weeknight. I probably had school too. We got up. My dad got, you know, we went in the car. Like any, my dad was famous as this thing. He'd always have the transistor radio with KMPC. So we'd be listening to that on the way back to the car. And then once we got to the car, we'd flip on KMPC and we listened to Bob Starr. And my dad said, hey, we're going to, you know, let's stop at Polly Pies. He's a pie nut. So we listened to this whole thing take place on the radio. We didn't see it. We left the game and we pulled up the Polly's Pies in Lake Forest, California, and heard the walk-off home run from inside the car there. And I think you had a similar story, right?
Almost identical. And I'm not sure what inning you left. I'm not sure that what inning you I left, but I was 22 years old, I believe. So I was at Cal State Fullerton University, and I was living over in an apartment near Cal State Fullerton. And I went with my roommate, my buddy, who was an Angels fan too. And we went to the ball game, but this time he had his mother and father with him, who had driven all the way up from Vista, California, which is San Diego County. So yeah, we actually, my buddy Tim and I had a rule that we would never leave a game early, ever, never. If we got tickets, we would never, ever leave a game early, because you never know. And especially if it was a close game. This game was not close. In fact, I think we were late because of his parents getting to the game. And you come in and they're like down by 7. It might have been 7. I don't know if the Tigers got a 7 spot in the first inning. But we had bought tickets. There was 4 people. We were sitting there. There were annoying Tigers fans with us that were chewing behind. We might have been in the same row. That's what I'm talking about.
Could have been.
But we had to get back to Fullerton. And we wanted to get something to eat. You know, everybody was hungry. And also, my roommate's parents had to drive all the way 80 miles down to San Diego County. So, you know, they said, hey, is it all right if we leave, right? And I was like, no, we can't leave. No, we can't leave. We can't leave. You know, something might happen. And they're like, no chance anything's going to happen. And I remember for sure. So we're all going to go eat. And we ended up eating at Herschel's restaurant in Fullerton, which is near my apartment. So I'm walking out and going to my car. And I just heard this massive roar from inside the stadium. And it was a roar that was massive. Like, you knew not something had significant had happened. But, you know, I'm even thinking the lineup in my head. Schofield's coming up. Nothing's going to happen. Walk to my car. I get in, turn it on to CanBC. And Dick Schofield hit a walk-off Grand Slam home run. And I was just so mad. I was so mad at my buddy and my buddy's parents for making us leave early. But, yeah, I mean, we didn't see that. You and I did not see that. And it was basically for the same reason. So you went to – yeah.
If you have your ticket stub, like I still have, I was in section 122. Row A, seat 13. So I saved that. That was how memorable it was. I've saved that in the scrapbook I kept for that year, along with the paper clippings there, which is like, doesn't really do it justice, but I got the paper clipping there with the, with this, this ticket in my, and it was a Friday night. It says Friday, August 29th on the scrapbook. So it wasn't a weeknight. But it was a Friday night.
Game. I believe it greatest comeback in Angels history. Maybe the greatest comeback. We were both there. No.
Dick Schofield wrapped up his career. He had 1,086 games with the Angels. He had 120 stolen bases during his time, and his 10.7 defensive WAR at the shortstop position is sixth best amongst all-time Angels. So great defensive player, awesome player, good guy, and great Angel. And I was excited to see him. I another thing I remember from him, I remember in the early days in spring training, he and Pettis came up together, and they always seemed to be like linked. They were always close. They were always leaving the locker room after the spring training games together. It seemed like they always had a pretty close connection as well. And I believe they both might have settled down in the South Orange County area in the same region there too, after their playing careers. But yeah, anyway, that's it. 41, Dick Schofield. Stu, I want to thank you for joining us again for another 60 on 60. We've gotten through the first 20, or the last 20, if you want to look at it that way, the back 20, and look forward to doing some more of these with you. And I want to thank everybody who has listened to this podcast, this video log on YouTube today. Thank you for joining us. If you do like this, please like it on YouTube. We hope you'll follow us and give us your feedback as well. We appreciate you joining us for another Halo Life. Stu, thanks for being our guest. And don't forget,
amen,
life is precious, man. And live your life nine innings at a time. We'll see you next time.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you, BJ. It's always a pleasure, never a chore with you.
And I love it. Thank you.